you're projecting that another human being is projecting. Your illusion is that it's their illusion. And to really see that destroys all defense and only presents a profound openness to deeply listen, which is the real heart of the message. It reminds me also of the phrase of treat others in the way that you would treat yourself, because when you treat others a certain way, you are treating yourself that way, because it's one. If you extend kindness to someone, you're the one that experiences kindness. You experience your own kindness. If you speak ill of another, you're the one who feels that ill towards another. And so you're giving it to yourself. Welcome to the space. I often see myself referenced as a non-duality teacher. And super cute. I can completely understand why that might be the assumption. I playfully don't agree. I don't see myself as a teacher, even though in appearances, I could see how it looks like that. What I'm doing again is just sharing what I see. It's interesting because it's like I don't feel like I even want to teach anything. Like I know how to do something and I'm going to teach you how to do it as well. It seems really foreign. But anyway, maybe some are listening and they're not familiar with what non-duality is. And really, to summarize, and it's really quite beautiful, it's a concept that's referred to in many different traditions. But as the name implies, non-duality, it's suggesting that the appearance of duality, this and that, is an illusionary one. Meaning that the things that we see as separate are not separate at all. That really all of these things are one thing. And we can look at this in the illustration of a magnet, where you have the apparent positive charge and then the negative side. And you can say that these are two separate things, the positive and the negative of a magnet. But yet they forever go together in such a way that you can't have a positive without a negative. If you get rid of the negative, you get rid of the positive. In fact, if you have a magnet and you think the negative side is ugly and you cut it off, you now have two magnets with both positive and negative. You can't get rid of it. And this also speaks just to experiences or things that we see in life, such as weather. There isn't summer or winter. There is life that sometimes looks like summer and sometimes look like winter, but they forever go together. And so if you hate one end of the spectrum, you're actually expressing hate toward the whole thing. If you hate the winter, you're actually hating life. If you love the summer, you're actually loving life. And it's interesting too, because in the same instant, you can't both hate or love life. Sure, you can oscillate back and forth really quickly, but in each given moment, there's either a love extended or a withholding of love. And the concept, the pointer, points towards a sacred unity in life, that there's only one, that there is not this or that. And furthermore, if there's only one, then you must be that one, because it's not the one and then you, that would be two. If there is only one, then what you are is that one. And furthermore, the concept points towards the illusion of separation between human beings, where we think that there is self and other. That would be two. That would be a duality. Now, yes, in appearances, it looks like that. But as you unwrap it, you start to see the illusionary nature of self and other, that there really isn't self and other. There's just the one pretending to be two. And our experience of self and other is really to experience a dream of self and other. It's to experience who I think I am as a separate something, and to experience who I think you are as a separate something. But those two characters are imaginary and don't really exist. Yet the reality of what exists is the one experiencing itself. And my God, this makes me want to go in a completely different direction for this topic, but we'll see if we can stay on point with the title, which is The Failure and Gift of Non-Duality. So often in spiritual concepts, there's a very innocent, understandable misunderstanding that leads us to cling to our initial assumptions about what these pointers mean. We cling to our belief in the concept rather than connecting more deeply with what they're pointing toward. And I guess we can jump right into the failure of non-duality as a concept. And, you know, besides the title of this episode, this really speaks to so many things. It speaks to all concepts. It speaks to all religions. It speaks to all spiritual methodologies, where if you unwrap all the religious texts and see them in a more sane perspective, they're saying the same thing as non-duality would be saying. It's like there's one truth, and that one truth gets described 1,000 different ways, and those 1,000 different ways are 1,000 different religions or 1,000 different concepts. And yet, as human beings, the failure is we believe in the concept rather than seeing what the concept is pointing to. We cling to the story rather than looking past the story. And to illustrate, as it relates to non-duality, and I've experienced this myself, and I've seen it experienced in lots of people who stumble upon non-duality, where the concept itself is quite fascinating, and it does a great job of explaining away the mind's content so it seems really true, like it makes sense. But in that making sense from the mind's perspective, we start believing our own sense making and thinking we know something, thinking that we figured something out. To illustrate the failure, I could share a bunch of insight about how everything's an illusion, that everything you experience is your own creation. The character that thinks it figured this out encounters another person who has a problem with them, and this person expresses their concern, their blame, their frustration, their anger. And then the character that we'll call Bob says, well, that's just an illusion, you know? That's actually your projection. And this helps Bob to seemingly not experience pain because he can deflect from the experience using this spiritual language, kind of hiding behind it. And I'm sure you've seen this, and you know, granted, you probably do this in some way. I think we all do in some way, especially in the spiritual community. And so because it makes sense to Bob, he can use this insight to create distance between him and the world's problems, other people's problems. And in appearances, it seems like it protects him. But do you also see how that creates separation? Right? If Bob tells somebody, your problem with me is actually your problem because there's no separation and you're experiencing your own illusion. Do you see how that's Bob separating himself from the other? Again, this happens even in all religious traditions, where in some way you think the insight that you discovered pertains to somebody else, which would imply separation. This is fun. And this is a point that I feel like I'm constantly trying to drive home, is that the discovery of these things is only for the one who's looking in this direction. Meaning that the discovery of these things isn't for your family, isn't for your partner, isn't for the world. That would imply separation. That would imply that there's two. That there's me and then there's other. This rapidly turns into some sort of dogma or ideology where, oh, I figured something out. Now, if only other people would figure it out too, then I could relax. Then the world would be at peace. And there's a really sacred reverence to be seen here, and also to recognize how that sort of activity is simply creating more separation, which distances you from the real heart of the matter. Again, in appearances, it seems like it protects you. It seems like it makes you feel significant, like you figured out something that everyone else needs to figure out, and you somehow have the solution. But this isn't about others at all. Again, being that all of these traditions, all of these concepts, in some way or another, are pointing toward a discovery that all is one, then that's for you. And again, as I'm looking at the camera right now, I'm talking to myself, which is such an important part of the expression, that I'm not doing this per se for others. This is for my own joy, to unwrap the gift, to unwrap the miracle, to look beyond the dream. Why? For the sake of my own sanity. And then in appearances, it looks like it helps others. If Bob really saw the heart of the message, what was really being pointed to, and then he encounters what appears to be another human being having a problem with him, he would recognize that his statement that says, you're just projecting, would be a statement that he's telling to himself. You're projecting that another human being is projecting. Your illusion is that it's their illusion. And to really see that destroys all defense and only presents a profound openness to deeply listen, which is the real heart of the message. It reminds me also of the phrase of treat others in the way that you would treat yourself. Why? Because when you treat others a certain way, you are treating yourself that way, because it's one. If you extend kindness to someone, you're the one that experiences kindness. You experience your own kindness. If you speak ill of another, you're the one who feels that ill towards another. And so you're giving it to yourself. This also illustrates nicely, in one particular way, how it's all one, how there's no other, and it only arises through appearances, where it looks like you're being kind to somebody else, but really you are expressing a kindness from within yourself, and you are experiencing that kindness that you're expressing. And we've all had the human experience where you're being kind to another, but they don't experience the kindness. Or it seems like you're expressing love to another, but they don't experience the love. There's something profound that happens when you start to recognize that there is no concept that can speak what's true. There's a beautiful letting go of all the concepts, a beautiful letting go of all the stories, not needing to know which story is the right story, because it's irrelevant. What's relevant is what the story is pointing to. And when you see what it's pointing to, it's self-evident. And you can't even really say anything about it. You can try, and it could be helpful, but it brings about an epic stillness where nothing has to be said, nothing has to be defended, right? How silly is that? And an illustration I like to use a lot is, if you give a tree a name, that name doesn't say anything at all about what the tree really is. Furthermore, the tree isn't separate from life. It's not its own thing. It is the totality of life pretending to be a tree. And so to call that something a tree, and to believe that it's your thoughts about it, turns it into something that's so incredibly limiting. And as human beings, we argue about which tree is, or which name is the right name for the tree, rather than connecting with its reality, which is also to connect with your reality, the reality. Human beings will go to war over what's the real name. And this all stems back to the human being's determination to protect its own name, its own concept of identity, right? Like, I mean, again, playfully speaking, like nationality, it's a concept, it's a label, it's a name. There's nothing real in life called an American. It's a concept, it's a pointer. But to identify with that concept, then if somebody says it's not real, or implies that it has no value, or makes silly comments against it, then you'll be offended, because that seems to threaten your belief in a concept that you're mistaking as reality. And this, of course, happens with religious tradition. You see, and again, this happens in all of it, non-duality included, where a concept will serve as a pointer towards a profound discovery that's beautiful, that's lovely, that exposes a tremendous amount of love. And the mind says, what the fuck was that? And then it looks at the concept and thinks it was the concept. and they say, oh, the concept's true. And then we spend the rest of our lives clinging to the concept. When there's identification with the concept, there's almost nothing you can say. You know, maybe you've experienced this in your own life where you were identified with a concept. That this happens, you know, whether it's religion, it can be dogma around food, it can be dogma around other elements of lifestyle, what you should or shouldn't do, and blah, 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 blah. And you can really think that you're right. You can really think that you figured it out. You can really think you found something, and no one can convince you otherwise. There's an intensity of identification, and it's so intense that subconsciously, there's an underlying terror that you might be wrong. The concept is defended at all costs to the point of war. That's the failure of all concept. The story does not serve a function in defining what's real and true. The story serves as a pointer. And not everyone will see what's being pointed to, which is beautiful. We resonate with different stories, given our conditioning. And so it's so beautiful that there's 1,000 different concepts, traditions, stories that point to the same thing in different ways. And when you know that it's not one particular story that's the right story, there's a freedom that allows the stories to be the stories. What is the gift of non-duality? Well, I think I've been speaking about that a little bit. It's the gift of all concepts. If there's resonance with a particular concept, then in some way or another, the concept is pointing for you to a profound truth that all is one, that all is well, that there's nothing to be lost, that you can relax. It's pointing beyond the mind's dream. And it's so beautiful to see all the different ways that it's described. And it's so beautiful also to see that it cannot be described. Because to really notice this, to notice that it cannot be articulated, that it cannot be thought about, draws you into a stillness. It draws you into a place where the mind cannot go, where you cannot claim it as your own and not others. It draws you into a space where there's no more separation and everything fits together perfectly, which is to touch upon such a sacred quality that's been worshipped since the beginning. Beautifully, what happens is someone gets a glimpse of this, of reality beyond the mind, and it's the most beautiful thing they've experienced, and they try and tell people, understandably. And that can come from a few different places. That can come from a genuine love and care, or it can come from a fear. But either way, it's beautiful. And these people that try to communicate it have the darndest time articulating it. And it often just becomes poetry. But it's so beautiful, you might as well try. There's also this beautiful invitation to just be a little bit patient with what you think you know, especially when it seems to involve other people. Because what's happening is we are clinging to a concept that we're using to protect our ego, which is fine. It's cute. But how's it going? And it requires a real, let's just call it courage, to call yourself out when this is happening. Courage, because it can perceivably threaten what you think you found. I love your question, Amanda. But what is wrong with wanting others to change? For example, violent people and bad stuff. There's no suggestion that it's wrong. You're free. There's no suggestion of what you should or shouldn't do. The invitation is to question what's really true. Maybe the invitation is to deeply ask yourself, why? Why do you want others to change? And there's going to be the surface level knee-jerk reaction that thinks it knows something that is actually covering up something else. But yeah, your follow-up, but what is the truth then? Make the world better? That's interesting, isn't it? Make the world better. So I know what would make the world better. So if everyone did what I thought they should do, then the world would be better. Which is saying that if people weren't free and were my prisoner, then the world would be better. Am I assuming that life is making a mistake? And I know. Am I assuming that life in its infinite wisdom in managing what appears to be 10,000 parts doesn't know what it's doing? But yet me and my limited perspective that sees a percentage that can't even be counted somehow knows how things should be. And so I want people to change because I know how they should be. Or do I want them to change so that I can relax, so that I can be at peace? Which shows me that I misunderstand the nature of peace. That's cute, Amanda. But we also need to take action, right? For example, violence is not good, right? You see, this gets into the realm of what's good and what's bad, which points back to what non-duality points to. You're free to see something as good. You're free to see something as bad. But in your seeing of those things as good as bad, good and bad, you're seeing them as separate things. And if you think you can get control over one side that's separate, you can get what you want on the other side that's separate. Just like the magnet that has positive and negative, you can look at the magnet that's negative part and say, oh, it's ugly. Oh, it's not doing what I want. Oh, it interrupts my peace. Let's get rid of it. And if only we got rid of the negative, then this would be a better place. And then you try and try and try and you cut the magnet in half. And now you have twice as much negative. Your effort to destroy one aspect multiplies it. This is trying to put out fire with fire. This is trying to end violence with violence. This is going to war for peace. And it's also interesting because in our playful lack of awareness in what's happening behind the scenes, beyond the mind's dream, we're completely unaware of our own violence. And we see the violence out there in others. But I invite us to ask ourselves, is my wanting other people to not be violent a form of violence? And what is violence really? Violence exists along a relative scale. You can look at the loud violence and think, oh, that's violent. But yet there are so many other flavors of violence. And again, concepts like violence can only happen when the truth of life is not being seen. Which, in other words, it's saying violence can only happen when separation is perceived. Furthermore, to perceive separation is violence. To see yourself as separate from the one who is violent is violent. That statement can sound like complete nonsense. Understood. Understood. But it only seems like nonsense from the perspective that separation is real. That people are separate. That all is not one. When you recognize that all is one, that you are the one, and the perceived other person that you're encountering that is violent is you, it completely changes the dynamic of how you interact with that situation. Where it's not a question of what should I do? What's the right thing? What's the wrong thing? There's something that automatically happens. It's not a question, which is part of the difficulty in the human experience that is, playfully speaking, asleep. They're looking at how to address all these things from the perspective of separation, and everything they end up doing reinforces separation, which is why it looks like no progress. To see violence is to create violence. The violence you see is the violence you put there. And I can just see the mind saying, Understandable. Understandable. The thing is if it's all one, if it's all one thing, then there's nothing other than the one. If you see something other than the one, you're putting it there. And if it was all one, the only thing that you would see is love. And so those appearances that end up looking like violence transform into an open space for love to flow. Gosh, so much beauty to it over there. My goodness. It's kind of a hot topic though, and I don't normally speak so publicly about concepts that deep, because it's not assimilated well for one who isn't in the space of being open to see what I'm pointing to beyond the words. All right, lovelies, let's switch gears and do this guided meditation. Welcome to this moment. Let's playfully step back from the mind's noise. Inviting ourselves into presence. We can see the mind's insanity. Thinking, thinking, thinking. This, that, and the other. Trying to put together 10,000 pieces that aren't really pieces at all. Running around in a dream. Going nowhere. So let's just take a break. recognize life's permission for you to just be here. Outside of the thinking mind, there's no demand, no expectation, no should this and should that. There's simply an empty space that invites you to rest. Let's take 3 deep breaths and just allow ourselves to fully come home. Let's breathe. Here we are, right now. Isn't it amazing how much isn't happening? How we were caught up in a dream of 10,000 stories. And yet, in reality, there's just this. This is your real home. This is what's really true. Thank you for meditating with me today.